Chapter 9. Andrei Trokhmi. We feel obliged to tell you that there are among us a certain number of Jews. 1. When France fell in June of 1940, the German army allowed the French to set up a government in the southern city of Vichy. It was headed by the French World War I hero, Marshal Philippe Pétain, who was granted the full powers of a dictator. Pétain cooperated actively with the Germans. He stripped Jews of their rights. He pushed them out of professions. Revoking laws against anti-Semitism, he rounded up French Jews and put them into internment camps and took a dozen other authoritarian steps, large and small, including the requirement that every morning French schoolchildren honor the French flag with a full fascist salute, right arm outstretched, palm down. On the scale of the adjustments necessary under German occupation, saluting the flag each morning was a small matter. Most people complied, but not those living in a town of Le Chambon-sur-Lignon. Le Chambon is one of a dozen villages on the Vivarais Plateau, a mountainous region not far from the Italian and Swiss borders in south-central France. The winters are snowy and harsh. The area is remote, and the closest large towns are well down the mountain, miles away. The region is heavily agricultural, with farms tucked away in and around piney woods. For several centuries, Le Chambon had been home to a variety of dissident Protestant sects, chief among them the Huguenots. The local Huguenot pastor was a man named Andrei Trokhmi. He was a pacifist. On the Sunday after France fell to the Germans, Trokhmi preached a sermon at the Protestant temple of Le Chambon. Loving, forgiving, and doing good to our adversaries is our duty, he said. Yet we must do this without giving up and without being cowardly. We shall resist whenever our adversaries demand of us obedience contrary to the orders of the gospel. We shall do so without fear, but also without pride and without hate. Giving the straight-armed fascist salute to the Vichy regime was, to Trokhmi's mind, a very good example of obedience contrary to the orders of the gospel. He and his co-pastor, Edouard Tailly, had started a school in Le Chambon several years earlier called the Collège Sevenon. They decided that there would be no flagpole and no fascist salutes at Sevenon. Vichy's next step was to require all French teachers to sign loyalty oaths to the state. Trokhmi, Tailly, and the entire staff of Sevenon refused. Pétain asked for a portrait of himself to be placed in every French school. Trokhmi and Tailly rolled their eyes. On the one-year anniversary of the Vichy regime, Pétain ordered towns across the country to ring their church bells at noon on August 1st. Trokhmi told the church custodian, a woman named Amélie, not to bother. Two summer residents of the town came and complained. The bell does not belong to the marshal, but to God, Emily told them flatly. It is rung for God, otherwise it is not rung. Throughout the winter and spring of 1940, conditions for Jews across Europe grew progressively worse. A woman appeared at the Trokhmi's door. She was terrified and trembling from the cold. She was Jewish, she said. Her life was in danger. She had heard Le Chambon was a welcoming place. And I said, come in, Andrei Trokhmi's wife Magda remembered years later. And so it started. Soon more and more Jewish refugees began showing up in Le Chambon. Trokhmi took the train to Marseille to meet with a Quaker named Burns Chalmers. The Quakers provided humanitarian aid for the internment centers that had been set up in southern France. The camps were appalling places, overrun with rats, lice, and disease. At one camp alone, 1,100 Jews died between 1940 and 1944. Many of those who survived were eventually shipped east and murdered in Nazi concentration camps. The Quakers could get people, especially children, out of the camps, but they had nowhere to send them. Trokhmi volunteered Le Chambon. The trickle of Jews coming up the mountain suddenly became a flood. In the summer of 1942, Georges Lemerand, the Vichy minister in charge of youth affairs, paid a state visit to Le Chambon. Pétain wanted him to set up youth camps around France, patterned after the Hitler youth camps in Germany. Lemerand swept up the mountain with his entourage, resplendent in his marine blue uniform. His agenda called for a banquet, then a march to the town stadium for a meeting with the local youth, then a formal reception. But the banquet did not go well. The food was barely adequate. Trocmé's daughter accidentally spilled soup down the back of Lemerand's uniform. During the parade, the streets were deserted. At the stadium, nothing was arranged. The children milled around, jostling and gawking. At the reception, a townsperson got up and read from the New Testament book of Romans, chapter 13, verse 8, "Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law." Then a group of students walked up to Lemerand and in front of the entire town presented him with a letter. It had been drafted with Trocmé's help. Earlier that summer, the Vichy police had rounded up 12,000 Jews in Paris at the request of the Nazis. Those arrested were held in horrendous conditions at the Vélodrome d'Hiver south of Paris before being sent to the concentration camp at Auschwitz. Le Chambon, the children made clear, wanted no part in any of this. "Mr. Minister," the letter began, "we have learned of the frightening scenes which took place 3 weeks ago in Paris, where the French police, on orders of the occupying power, arrested in their homes all the Jewish families in Paris to hold them in the Val d'Ive. The fathers were torn from their families and sent to Germany, the children torn from their mothers, who underwent the same fate as their husbands. We are afraid that the measures of deportation of the Jews will soon be applied in the southern zone. We feel obliged to tell you that there are among us a certain number of Jews, but we make no distinction between Jews and non-Jews. It is contrary to the gospel teaching. If our comrades, whose only fault is to be born in another religion, received the order to let themselves be deported, or even examined, they would disobey the order received, and we would try to hide them as best we could. We have Jews. You're not getting them. 2. Why didn't the Nazis come to Le Chambon and make an example of the residents? The enrollment at the school, started by Trocmé and Théhy, rose from 18 pupils on the eve of the war to 350 by 1944. It didn't take any great powers of deduction to figure out who those extra 332 children were. Nor did the town make any great secret of what it was doing. "We are obliged to tell you that there are among us a certain number of Jews." One aid worker described coming up on the train from Lyon several times a month with a dozen or so Jewish children in tow. She would leave them at the Hotel May by the train station and then walk around town until she found homes for them all. In France, under the laws of Vichy, transporting and hiding Jewish refugees was plainly illegal. At other points during the war, the Nazis had demonstrated that they were not inclined to be conciliatory on the question of Jews. At one point, the Vichy police came up and set up shop in Le Chambon for 3 weeks, searching the town and the surrounding countryside for Jewish refugees. All they could come up with were two arrests, one of whom they later released. Why didn't they just line up the whole town and ship them to Auschwitz? Philippe Elie, who wrote the definitive history of Le Chambon, argues the town was protected at the end of the war by Major Julius Schmeling, a senior Gestapo official in the region. There were also many sympathetic people in the local Vichy police. Sometimes André Trocmé would get a call in the middle of the night warning him that a raid was coming the next day. Other times, a local police contingent would arrive, following up on a tip about hidden refugees, and treat themselves to a long cup of coffee at the local café first, to give everyone in town ample warning of their intentions. The Germans had enough on their plate, particularly by 1943, when the war on the Eastern Front began to go sour for them. They might not have wanted to pick a fight with a group of disputatious and disagreeable mountain folk. But the best answer for why Le Chambon persisted is the one that David and Goliath has tried to make plain, that wiping out a town or a people or a movement is never as simple as it looks. The powerful are not as powerful as they seem, nor the weak as weak. The Huguenots of Le Chambon were descendants of France's original Protestant population, and the truth is that people had tried and failed to wipe them out before. The Huguenots broke away from the Catholic Church during the Reformation, which made them outlaws in the eyes of the French state. One king after another tried to make them reunite with the Catholic Church. The Huguenot movement was banned. There were public roundups and massacres. Thousands of Huguenot men were sent to the gallows. Women were imprisoned for life. Children were put in Catholic foster homes in order to rid them of their faith. The Reign of Terror lasted more than a century. In the late 17th century, 200,000 Huguenots fled France for other countries in Europe and North America. Those few who remained were forced underground. They worshipped in secrecy in remote forests. They retreated to high mountain villages on the Vivarais Plateau. They formed a seminary in Switzerland and smuggled clergy across the border. They learned the arts of evasion and disguise. They stayed and learned, as the Londoners did during the Blitz, that they were not really afraid. They were just afraid of being afraid. "The people in our village knew already what persecutions were," Magda Trockmé said. "They talked often about their ancestors. Many years went by and they forgot, but when the Germans came, they remembered, and they were able to understand the persecution of the Jews perhaps better than people in other villages, for they already had a kind of preparation." When the first refugee appeared at her door, Magda Trockmé said it never occurred to her to say no. "I did not know that it would be dangerous. Nobody thought of that." "I did not know that it would be dangerous. Nobody thought of that." In the rest of France, all people thought about was how dangerous life was. But the people of Le Chambon were past that. When the first Jewish refugees arrived, the townsfolk drew up false papers for them. Not a difficult thing to do if your community has spent centuries hiding its true beliefs from the government. They hid the Jews in the places they had been hiding refugees for generations and smuggled them across the border to Switzerland along the same trails they had used for 300 years. Magda Trockmé went on, "Sometimes people ask me, how did you make a decision?" There was no decision to make. The issue was, do you think we are all brothers or not? Do you think it is unjust to turn in the Jews or not? Then let us try to help. In attempting to wipe out the Huguenots, the French created instead a pocket in their own country that was all but impossible to wipe out. As André Trockmé once said, how could the Nazis ever get to the end of the resources of such a people? 3. André Trockmé was born in 1901. He was tall and solidly built and had a long nose and sharp blue eyes. He worked tirelessly, lumbering from one end of Le Chambon to the other. His daughter Nellie writes that a sense of duty exuded from his pores. He called himself a pacifist, but there was nothing pacifistic about him. He and his wife Magda were famous for their shouting matches. He was often described as a violent man conquered by God. "A curse on him who begins in gentleness," he wrote in his journal. "He shall finish in insipidity and cowardice, and shall never set foot in the great liberating current of Christianity." 6 months after the visit from Minister Lemerand, Trockmé and Edouard Tailly were arrested and imprisoned in an internment camp, where, according to Ali, personal possessions were taken from them and noses were measured to ascertain whether or not they were Jewish. After a month, the two were told they would be released, but only on the condition that they pledged to obey without question orders given me by governmental authorities for the safety of France and for the good of the national revolution of Marshal Pétain. Trockmé and Tailly refused. The director of the camp came up to them in disbelief. Most of the people in the camp would end up dead in a gas chamber in exchange for signing their name on a piece of paper to a bit of patriotic boilerplate. The two men were getting a free ticket home. "What is this?" the camp director shouted at them. "This oath has nothing in it contrary to your conscience. The marshal wishes only the good of France." "On at least one point, we disagree with the marshal," Trockmé replied. He delivers the Jews to the Germans. When we get home, we shall certainly continue to be opposed, and we shall certainly continue to disobey orders from the government. How could we sign this now? Finally, the prison officials gave up and sent them home. Later in the war, when the Gestapo stepped up their scrutiny of Le Chambon, Trocmé and Tailly were forced to flee. Tailly joined up with the underground and spent the remainder of the war ferrying Jews across the Alps to the safety of Switzerland. It was not reasonable, he explained to Ali of his decision, but you know, I had to do it anyway. Trocmé moved from town to town, carrying false papers. Despite his precautions, he was arrested in a police roundup at the Lyon railway station. He was thrown into turmoil, not just at the prospect of discovery, but also, and more crucially, at the question of what to do about his false papers. Ali writes, his identity card gave his name as Biguet, and they would ask him if this was indeed true. Then he would have to lie to hide his identity. But he was not able to lie. Lying, especially to save his own skin, was sliding towards those compromises that God had not called upon me to make, he wrote in his autobiographical notes on this incident. Saving the lives of others, and even saving his own life with false identity cards, was one thing, but standing before another human being and speaking lies to him only for the sake of self-preservation was something different. Is there really a moral difference between giving yourself a false name on your identity card and stating that false name to a police officer? Perhaps not. Trocmé, at the time, was traveling with one of his young sons. He was still actively engaged in the business of hiding refugees. He had plenty of extenuating circumstances, in other words, to justify a white lie. But that is not the point. Trocmé was disagreeable in the same magnificent sense as Jay Freireich and Wyatt Walker and Fred Shuttlesworth. And the beauty of the disagreeable is that they do not make calculations like the rest of us. Walker and Shuttlesworth had nothing to lose. If your house has been bombed and the Klan has surrounded your car and pummeled you with their fists, how can things get any worse? Jay Freireich was told to stop what he was doing and warned that he was risking his career. He was heckled and abandoned by his peers. He held dying children in his arms and jabbed a thick needle into their shin bones. But he had been through worse. The Huguenots, who put their own self-interest first, had long ago converted to some other faith or given up or moved away. What was left was stubbornness and defiance. The arresting officer, it turned out, never asked for Trocmé's papers. Trocmé talked the police into taking him back to the railway station, where he met up with his son and slipped out a side door. But had the police asked him if he was Biguet, he had already decided to tell the truth. I am not Monsieur Biguet. I am Pastor André Trocmé. He didn't care. If you are Goliath, how on earth do you defeat someone who thinks like that? You could kill him, of course, but that is simply a variant of the same approach that backfired so spectacularly for the British in Northern Ireland and for the Three Strikes campaign in California. The excessive use of force creates legitimacy problems, and force without legitimacy leads to defiance, not submission. You could kill André Trocmé, but in all likelihood, all that would mean is that another André Trocmé would rise in his place. When Trocmé was 10 years old, his family drove one day to their house in the country. He was in the back seat with his two brothers and a cousin. His parents were in the front. His father grew angry at a car driving too slowly in front of them and pulled out to pass. "Paul, Paul, not so fast. There's going to be an accident," his mother cried out. The car spun out of control. The young André pushed himself away from the wreckage. His father and brothers and cousin were fine. His mother was not. He saw her lying lifeless 30 feet away. Confronting a Nazi officer paled in comparison with seeing your mother's body by the side of the road. As Trocmé wrote many years later, "If I have sinned so much, if I have been since then so solitary, if my soul has taken such a swirling and solitary movement, if I have doubted everything, if I have been a fatalist, and have been a pessimistic child who awaits death every day and who almost seeks it out, if I have opened myself slowly and late to happiness, and if I am still a somber man, incapable of laughing wholeheartedly, it is because you left me that June 24th upon that road. But if I have believed in eternal realities, if I have thrust myself towards them, it is also because I was alone, because you were no longer there to be my God, to fill my heart with your abundant and dominating life. It was not the privileged and the fortunate who took in the Jews in France. It was the marginal and the damaged, which should remind us that there are real limits to what evil and misfortune can accomplish. If you bomb a city, you leave behind death and destruction, but you create a community of remote misses. If you take away a mother or a father, you cause suffering and despair, but one time in 10, out of that despair rises an indomitable force. If you take away the gift of reading, you create the gift of listening. You see the giant and the shepherd in the valley of Elah, and your eye is drawn to the man with the sword and shield and the glittering armor. But so much of what is beautiful and valuable in the world comes from the shepherd, who has more strength and purpose than we ever imagine. The eldest son of Magda and André Trocmé was Jean-Pierre. He was a sensitive and gifted adolescent. André Trocmé was devoted to him. One evening, near the end of the war, the family went to see a recital of Villon's poem, The Ballad of the Hanged. The next night, they came home from dinner and found Jean-Pierre hanging from a noose in the bathroom. Trocmé stumbled into the woods, crying out, "Jean-Pierre, Jean-Pierre." Later, he wrote, "Even today I carry a death within myself, the death of my son, and I am like a decapitated pine. Pine trees do not regenerate their tops. They stay twisted, crippled." But surely he must have paused when he wrote those words, because everything that had happened in Le Chambon suggested there was more to the story than that. Then he wrote, "They grow in thickness, perhaps, and that is what I am doing."
This has been a Hachette audio production of David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants, written and read by Malcolm Gladwell. Produced by Cheryl Smith. Directed by John McElroy. Recorded by Jared O'Connell. Post-production by Gabino Reyes. David and Goliath is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2013 by Malcolm Gladwell. Audio production copyright 2013, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.